Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Toby Green about his book, A Fistful of Shells, West Africa from the Rise of the Slave Trade to the Age of Revolution. Toby, welcome back to New Books Network.
Mark, it's great to be here again.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, so I'm a historian based in the United Kingdom. I teach at King's College London. I teach in the Departments of History and Spanish, Portuguese, and Latin American Studies. I trained in area studies, in African studies, what was then the Center for West African Studies at the University of Birmingham, which was one of the oldest centers for training people in African studies here in the UK. My advisor of my PhD was the Brazilian historian of Songhai and Timbuktu, Paulo Moraes Farias. And he is one of the few people in this country who really works on, well, the transition between what you would call medieval and early modern African history, or ancient Africa, if you like, Timbuktu and Songhai. And so that really is one of the ways in which I began to become interested in and trained in the history of pre-colonial Africa, which I explore in this book.
I think that's the way you framed it's very interesting from the standpoint of approaching this book in particular, because we talk about medieval and early modern, and those are very much Western terminologies. And one of the things that I took from reading your book is just how artificial they are, and how they really impose Western, concepts and ways of thinking about African history that aren't entirely appropriate.
Well, correct. I mean, medieval. They're categories which makes life easy for historians, is that really something that people writing history should have in the forefront of their mind? I would say probably not. They're categories which also, can make sense in terms of people coming into a university and beginning to study in some more depth, but they're very artificial. But they impose, as you say, categories which come from European history. Medieval is fundamentally a category which derives from feudalism, the relationship between a particular idea of land, of the relationship between seigneurs and tenants, serfs, and all of that, which is obviously completely inappropriate to any other part of the world, frankly. And early modern, this book's main focus is what is generally called the early modern period. I guess one of the interesting things about that concept for this book is that one of the things the book shows is that towards the end of that period, maybe it's not so inappropriate to use the same term to describe different parts of the Atlantic basin, because they became so deeply interconnected. Those interconnections are part of the history of the rise of modernity. It is clearly a Europe. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about it as a category, though, is that when you say early modern, you think European history, or you think North American history, and you might think colonial Latin American history, but you never think African history. And so that's one of the things that the book explores, really.
What was it that led you to write a book like this? You've contributed numerous books to the field before, including your previous one, which was on the transatlantic slave trade. What led you to focus upon West Africa in the way that you did within this globalization context?
Well, a number of things, really. I mean, it's funny to answer the question, how do you come to the idea of a book? And there's not really any particular one thing. In the first place, there is the sense that this is, in general, a hugely underexplored, under-researched field, which also is also hugely contentious in numbers of ways because of the sources, because of the positionality of the author, because of the way in which prejudice has generally been associated with the reception of African history in the West. And at the same time, there is also another important context, I think, which is the increasing way in which many people who train as historians of pre-colonial Africa, particularly in the US, actually, in the 90s, and in the early 2000s, have become more what you might call Atlantic historians. They're focusing on the diaspora and the relationship between Africa and the Americas. And kind of Africa gets left out of that story more and more. And that's very problematic. So that's one aspect, a sort of awareness of the need to have a focus on Africa. And also, I think beyond that, in terms of my approach here, that was something which came out of my research. And it wasn't something where I sat down after finishing my previous book, which was published in 2012, and said, right, I'm going to start this now. It was something which came out of several different things, really. First, researching the archives. As I write in the introduction, the discovery of more and more material related to currencies, related to the economic relationships between African traders and rulers and Atlantic traders, and the way in which this was, as we know, a trade. What were the economic impacts of that, and how did those impacts relate to the nature of West African societies and their transformations in this period? So that was something which came out of the research. And then I think more deeply than that, it came out of the fact, you know, I'm a historian whose research training in West Africa didn't begin in the library and the archive, but began in the field. I spent a number of years living and working in West African in a variety of contexts before I began training as a historian. And some of that emerges in the book, in fact. And in fact, I write about some of that in the book. And, there is this sense somehow that historians are supposed to be objective. They're supposed to be library scholars. And this is a very misleading, I think, and false, frankly, representation of what the work of the historian is. Because even if you're in a library or an archive doing a lot of work, you are in a social situation, you're interacting with your environment, you're actually often very alone, you're very solitary, and all of that, of course, will be reflected in what you write. But similarly, for a historian of West Africa, you know, your interactions with people, communities, the length of time you spend in various places, of course, it shapes your perspective and how and the things you come to see as important. And so what I very much didn't want this book to be was a kind of sense that this is the final word, this is an objective history, this is... One of the reviews has said, you know, it's a personal history in the best sense. And that I'm trying to show, yes, my positionality, yes, my perspective, but also in doing that, saying, first of all, this isn't the final word. And secondly, that actually, of course, is true of all histories and bringing that into the history that I've written.
It's one of the things I thought was really fascinating about your text was because in a way that I've rarely seen in the history books that I've read, you've inserted yourself into it. It's not, you know, Toby Green's encounter with Africa, you know, throughout the book. It's not a travelogue. But in doing so, periodically in your book, you're showing that engagement with it, which I, as a non-Africanist, found very fascinating because you're showing, in a sense, how there's all of this material related to the history of Africa that we can use to understand Africa, which we really haven't been tapping into, that you do with this book.
Yes, I mean, I try to do that, and for various reasons. Firstly, you know, I take very much to heart the idea that, you know, the tradition of the Western Academy has been what the philosopher from Cameroon, Achille Mbembe, describes, and I mentioned this in the foreword, as, you know, the objective, impartial observer who's able to produce an objective text regardless of their place in the world. So in a sense, over and above their positionality, and that's clearly a false perspective. So one of the things I'm doing by inserting myself into the history is undercutting that, is saying, actually, you know, we have to be honest about that. We are all individual researchers in a social context. Clearly, that shapes what we research and how we think about it. But also, as you say, I think one of the things that that I'm also trying to do in the book is showing through those insertions that actually there are lots of sediments of memory, of social practice, of interactions historically, which are recorded in societies in various ways, which are completely outside of the canon of traditionally accepted historical sources in the West. And those are things which are actually fundamental, not only for retaining or reconstituting elements of history, but also, I think, very much for shaping perspectives, you know, what we think of as an important perspective on history. If we're just using written sources produced in the West, we're going to have a view, I think, as I say in the foreword, that African history in this period, West African history in this period, was all about trade, slavery, warfare, and African-European relations. That will be the sense that that was what was important. If you turn the lens around and look, for example, at oral records, you'll get the perspective that what was really important were kinship relations, genealogies, migration, kingship, religion, and of course, the reality is between the two. So that's why it's very important to have a really broad mix of source materials to attempt to write a book like this.
Now, I'm sure there's a few listeners who are familiar with oral histories and other forms that are, you know, out there that they use in terms of reconstructing the past. One of the things that makes your book so fascinating, though, was how you're able to draw upon sources that have only recently been collected, and yet in those sources you can use to reach 500 years back in the past in a way that may not necessarily seem to be the case. We think of oral history as a person recording their memories, or maybe a person recording stories that speak to a recent past or maybe a very traditional past. And you're talking about how you can use a lot of these sources to reach back and understand something about something 400 or 500 years ago that you wouldn't think work with either of those poles, but are nonetheless very informative and very insightful.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think, again, it comes back to one of the things I was talking about just before about, you know, about historical perspectives, about what we consider to be important. You know, is history the production of a factual narrative with levels of analysis? And what constitutes a fact? How is a fact recorded? You know, if you spend time in archives, for example, and this is one of the things I find fascinating, if you spend time in archives reading documents produced by Portuguese or French or English slave traders, of course, every time you turn the page, a little bit of the piece of paper fragments and disappears. And that one of the things that's always done to me is made me realize just how tenuous the recollection of the past is. These documents survived by chance. They could have sunk on a ship. They could have been destroyed in a fire. They could have, you know, fragmented because of humidity. They're there. And they give us the facts. But of course, they're just some facts. They're not a complete. And they have a very partial view of facts because of those factors. So it's an inappropriate approach to think that that is what we that is what a history of West Africa should be trying to produce. And then those documents, of course, produce a certain sort of, as I mentioned, a certain type of perspective on what is really supposed to be really important. Now, oral sources are not necessarily going to produce facts that would be recognized by the historical community. They might do, but they might equally produce fascinating perspectives on what people see and saw as important in those periods, on clothing, on, for example, on what people were Mark, I've just had to pause there. That might have to be edited. On clothing, for example, on jewellery, on hair, dress, those kinds of things, which were very fundamental to how they saw the importance and perspective of their social world and their social realms. And so that gives a totally different sense of what was really important and fundamental to society and to people at that time, and can really reshape it and give a different perspective on history.
I'd like to take us now to some of the insights that are coming out of this new material, particularly with regard to West Africa during the period between the 15th and the 17th centuries. What is it that is that this this you know material that you're now introducing into our understanding of the history, telling us about this period in Africa and its place in the world?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Mark. And there are a few things that we can pull out here. And I think I'll start with actually the role of West African languages in helping us to understand or get a different perspective and different information, different insights into what was happening. So the first example is one I use in the book, early in the book, is from Manding. So, and the relationship actually between keywords in Manding. So Manding, one of the main languages, the main language of what was the Mali Empire in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, and one of the main languages spoken widely across the greater Senegambian region. And the relationship between words to do with trade and credit in Manding and words in Portuguese. So, for example, the word for market in Manding is feira, and in Portuguese it is feira. The word for credit in Manding is juro, and in Portuguese it is juro. So already there, we're seeing quite an important connection between Atlantic trade, global trade, and the way in which that influenced and changed the relationship in commercial exchange in that part of West Africa and the relationship between Manding traders and Portuguese traders. Another example coming from right at the end of the period, if we move ourselves around to the Gold Coast or what's now Republic of Ghana, would come from Akan and the origins of the Asante Empire, as it was in the 18th century, the major state in what's now Ghana. The origins of Asante come from the Akan phrase Esantifor. Esantifor means because of war. Asante was formed because of war, and it was formed through the strength of the rising militarized state, not only in Asante, actually, but in other parts of West Africa, and the relationship between the state and warfare. Now, that's very important. I go on to that in the second half of the book, because it also, of course, shows some connections between processes of state formation in West Africa and actually processes of state formation in that period in Europe. In Europe, European historians have this concept of what they call the fiscal military state. What that means is the relationship between the growing importance of the state, taxation, and warfare. Actually, you see through Asante IV and the origins of Asante, very similar structures and forces at play in the rise of that state in what's now Ghana. So we learn quite a lot just from those few examples, and there are many more which you could pull out, but there's quite a lot about both process of state formation, relationships between West African polities and Atlantic empires, and also interconnections of trade, commerce, and social transformations. Just in those few examples, we could talk about many, many more of them, but that's just a sense of the flavor of how I try to bring some of those sources into the approach I take in the book.
One of the things that you do with the sources that I really like is that you point out that for too long, the use of the sources that we have previously been employing has led us to see this as a process that was heavily tied to just the European interaction. But as you explain that when you draw upon a wider range of sources, you can see how a lot of the state formation predates this. West Africa's involvement in the global economy dates back to what we would, you know, think of as, you know, characterizing the West as the medieval period, with its integration with these Islamic trading networks or that existed in Central and Northern Africa in the, you know, 13th, 14th centuries.
Absolutely. So, yes, I mean, we, as you say, because of the types of sources which tend to have been used in the study of this period of history in Africa, and the way that those sources privilege precisely European-African interactions, the slave trade, and so forth, you kind of get a sense that that was the fundamental thing which everybody would have been thinking about in West Africa in this period of time. And by taking, as you say, first of all, by taking ourselves back in time, back prior to those engagements and seeing the structures which were already in place and also the interactions between, for example, Kano in northern Nigeria, Nupe, which was in central Nigeria, and between Nupe and kingdoms like Benin, the famous Benin Bronzes, were actually interacting with some of those kingdoms. So the trans-Saharan networks, which stretched from Kano northwards across the Sahara towards Tripoli, They were also influencing, of course, right down on the Atlantic coastline in the much long prior to the arrival of the Portuguese in the 15th century. And so all of those social and political and commercial structures were already very much in place. But the other thing I think which the concentration on those European sources does is, as I say, it makes you think that from that point on, everybody was thinking in West Africa, these were the main things that mattered. Of course, they did matter. But one of the things I do in the book at one point is say, well, actually, of course, you know, what were people often thinking about? They were thinking about the new fashions which were coming in, the new types of hairstyle, new jewelry, what they were going to eat tomorrow night, social connections. There are so many aspects of social history, which, of course, those sources simply can tell us absolutely nothing about and which really don't convey the complexity and the richness of the human experience at that time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Perhaps you can now set the stage as to what Africa was like during that period prior to the heavy involvement with European trade, because I thought it was very fascinating how that, you know, it's a very different portrait, and it's one that I think really helps to explain just the ways in which trade with Europe does change the region, not just in terms of how it, you know, changed Europe or how it changed global trade, but how it changed West Africa specifically, which is something that oftentimes gets glossed over in earlier accounts.
Sure. So, well, I mean, so West, I mean, West Africa, of course, the first thing to say, West Africa is a huge region. I mean, and the book, you know, the book is deliberately comparative across a wide region. Obviously, I know some parts of the region better than others. I mean, I have done research in 8 different countries across the region, but, you know, there are many more than that. So that's an important starting point. And I think it's probably at this point worth saying, you know, why take on such a huge canvas? Well, I think there are important reasons for doing that. And the first is that one of the main focuses of the book is to try and show how the economic dimension is one of the things which ultimately does begin to provide a commonality to historical experience across that whole region. It's actually only by looking across that whole region that you can get a sense of the importance of the economic dimension. But the other is, look, you know, just as we know very well from the famous blog, Africa is not a country. We know Africa is not, everybody knows Africa is not a country. But at the same time, we have to recognize that that idea of the specificity of every single people comes from colonial era anthropology. Colonial era anthropologists developed this idea of the specificity of ethnicity and a sense that those kind of comparisons couldn't be made. So in one sense, I would say you're damned if you follow that route, and you're damned if you don't. It creates a very difficult a framework within which to work as a historian. But at the same time, we have to recognize, you know, people write comparative histories of all other parts of the world. People write comparative histories of different countries in Europe, in different parts of Asia, in the Americas. Is it just Africa that's not possible to do in? And if so, why? There's another form of exceptionalism, in fact. So that's why the book looks at the whole region. And it's important to make that clear at this point. But also to answer what your question actually was, which is what was that region like? Well, there were important areas of interconnection, as I've mentioned, or, you know, in the previous answer to the previous question, you know, there was an important area of interconnection between, for example, northern Nigeria was connected to, as I've said, through various different trading routes and political relationships, both to central areas of what is now central and southern Nigeria, but also two parts of the northern reaches of what are now the Gold Coast, so the gold trade from the main gold prospecting areas, which are what were in the forests of what's now southern Ghana. There were trading routes, important trading routes north towards what's now Timbuktu in Mali to northern Nigeria. And those areas were also connected towards Senegambia. So Mali in particular had strong social and political connections and commercial connections towards Senegambia. So it's a region which has a very broad range of connections, which are both commercial, as I've mentioned here, but also, as you mentioned, religious. So a lot of that trade is conducted by Islamic traders who are connected to, of course, the North Trans-Saharan trade across to North Africa. And because, you know, this is an incredibly slow, dangerous but also potentially lucrative trade, it's the risks are high. And for that reason, that's one of the reasons some people feel that there was a shared religion. You know, how do you trust somebody who you're trading with, say in Tripoli, who you may never see, or who you may see once every 4 or 5 years, and a shared religious identity and faith and practice is, of course, a very important part of how that can happen. So Islam emerges as an important gateway, if you like, to this globe, to this trading network, which links not only to North Africa, but of course also through North Africa to what's now called the Middle East and into Asia. And so you end up with these, and that's very important because it means that the political elites in West Africa, for them, Islam was an important religion because it offered a gateway for the arrival of new goods, new forms of wealth and so forth. But at the same time, of course, the vast majority of the West African population were not practicing Muslim. So they had to develop a kind of plural religious identity, which became an important part of West African political statecraft. The idea that there could be a sort of pluralism, what we would call today probably multiculturalism, within West Africa, particularly within urban spaces in West Africa, and also multilingualism. You know, the fact that this was a very interconnected area, people traveling long distance to North Africa, but also within West Africa, meant that that kind of plural identity was actually very important to West African societies. And this is an important part of the transformations which also developed, you know, from the 15th and 16th century onwards.
One of the most fascinating tools you use to trace what's going on here is following the currencies. And it was interesting for me to think about how you use those to talk about various trade networks and how they were using currencies. And this is, of course, is you know, best illustrated by the very title of your book, A Fistful of Shells, about how it's not just the metalism that we are so used to in the West, but you're talking about currency in cloth and currency in shells that allows you to identify where these trading networks are. And this is also very important because you then use them to trace the disruptions that take place in the 15th centuries onward.
Yes, and that's very important because, as you say, it is, you know, the overarching motif which unites the book together is the focus on currencies, money, and the way that that can be traced over time through this long period of time. And it's also very important to emphasize that all of the currencies which begin to be traded by the Portuguese from the late 15th into the early 16th century onwards are already in place across West Africa. Cowries are already in use as a major currency on the Niger Bend. Copper manillas or arm rings are already in use. For iron, cloth, all these things are already in place. So it's not like the Portuguese invented monetary transactions, invented markets in some way by bringing these currencies. No, they were good imitators. You know, we all know really that nothing grows, nothing starts from scratch. Everything develops from what is already there. The Portuguese saw what was happening, saw the commercial realities which are there, and then, you know, because of their mobility, because they had access to maritime routes which were not so well practiced or known by other nations, they were able to import huge numbers of cowries from the Indian Ocean, which they brought as ballast in their ships, which came back from Goa. They were able then to import large numbers of copper arm manufactured in Europe, and they imported those. And this, of course, expanded hugely the currency base in in many West African parts. And essentially, it monetized to a larger extent than it had already been present. Although those currencies were there, that monetization expanded hugely. Markets expanded hugely, and that's been a huge part of the story of pre-colonial West Africa in this period from the 16th to the 18th centuries. Is the impact which that has, and why this is important is, you know, well, for various reasons, but a reductive focus on this period of African history through the lens of the transatlantic slave trade means that the wider economic implications of that have traditionally been lost from that analysis. And actually, that is one of the main foci of the book. As you say, it allows to see not only what those trade routes were, how West African nations interacted with them and were affected by them, but also what the long-term economic disruptive impact of that was.
And I like your use of the word disruptive, because it really gets to the way in which your book argues that we need to properly view what's going on here. It's not as though Africa is just sitting there and then a bunch of Portuguese say, hey, we've discovered you. Instead, what they're doing is they're inserting themselves directly into this region, and they are then introducing these new linkages across the Atlantic Ocean. And that, of course, is what is where we start to see slavery playing a very different role than it previously had. I was wondering if you could perhaps, you know, briefly talk about where slavery fits into this, both prior to this period of the, you know, emergence of the transatlantic trade, and then how that changes a lot of what's going on within West Africa.
Well, that could be a whole new interview, Mark.
Be brief, concise, and specific.
Yeah, if I can try to do that. I think the first thing is to recognize the impact of using the concept of slavery. Slavery, to the English speaker, to the Western mind, implies a certain set of relations, which actually is inappropriate for thinking about West Africa prior to European contact. And what is called slavery in those eras were forms of dependence, economic, social, political, but they were not the same form of dependence as the concept of slavery, which as it emerged in the Americas implies, which is a certain form of legal, you know, the idea of chattel slavery, the legal position of slaves in American societies, in colonial American societies, which is very, very different to the forms of slavery that you had in West Africa prior to the 15th and 16th centuries. A number of scholars wrote about that actually a long time ago. So Walter Rodney, one of the founding historians who worked on this region of pre-colonial Africa before he wrote his landmark book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, argued in one of his first academic articles that there was no slavery as slavery in the region of Senegambia, as we would call it today, as we call slavery today, prior to Portuguese arrival. And he used various numbers of sources to look at that. We're talking about human relationships of dependence, often in times of drought, warfare, and often in terms of insiders and outsiders. So many people, quote, slaves in West African societies were outsiders to the communities in which they lived. They had no... They often might have been war captives, or they might have migrated in times of drought. They wouldn't necessarily have had kinship connections within their communities. And so they were incorporated within as members of a community, but as members of a community who didn't have certain rights, essentially. However, of course, their children who had been born in that community would therefore be able to develop, had by virtue of that kinship connections, and would begin to develop more community rights. So it was a way. It was an institution really which allowed societies to expand and to develop more members over time. And that's, of course, you know, in the way in which I described that, you can see that that's a very different institution to the institution of slavery in the Americas. Now, over the one of the fascinating things and one of the very important things I think about this is that over the period then from the late 15th to into the 19th century, one of the real transformations in Africa is that slavery as a relationship of dependence becomes more and more like the institution as it's known in the Americas. And by the 19th century, you have Rodney wrote about this, and Paul Lovejoy has more recently written about this with relationship to the Sokoto Caliphate in Nigeria in the 19th century, how the plantations there and the relationships there of dependency and of labor were much more akin to American systems of relationship by that time. So there is actually a real transformation in slavery in Africa over this period of time, and it is clearly related to the global connections which Africa has with the Atlantic world.
You use a phrase in the book that I just thought was just so nicely chosen for it, which is the commercialization of people, and how that and I thought that so nicely encapsulated what's happening with the institution of slavery during this period that you're studying.
Absolutely, and then that's another aspect. So yes, thank you for prompting me on that. Yes, that's another aspect. We have to recognize that over time, as this relationship between Atlantic slavery and relationships of dependence in Africa becomes more and more intertwined, so in the 16th century, but particularly when you get to the latter part of the 17th century, from that point on, human beings become, as you say, they're commercialized. They become forms of capital, forms of stores of capital from the labor which they're going to be able to produce, and through the exchange of those bodies, which enables the Atlantic system to function. And this reality that human beings became forms of currency, became commercialized, is, I think really emphasizes the moral, quote, in quote, or immoral transformations with the transatlantic slave trade implanted in human societies, and how, just how far and how deeply those transformations affected people. I mean, there can be no more base transformation than that, and that was something that commercialization, which emerged from the influence which the Americas was having within West African societies, and the ways in which, in order to access capital, African societies then were required to transform their own relationships of human interdependence and dependence in this era.
Now, you've divided the book into two parts. We've spent some time now just covering the first part of the book, which is where you're talking about the West Africa during the 15th and 17th centuries. And the second part is when you're discussing West Africa in the 18th century. But obviously, as you make clear, it's not as though there's this sharp dividing line that separates the two, that we're talking about a period of transition. And one of the things you do is you talk about how the Kingdom of Congo in particular is a good example of that transition taking place during the, in particular, the late 17th through the early 18th centuries. I was wondering if you could perhaps sort of explain how the microcosm that is of this evolution that's taking place between the period that you spend talking about in the first half of the book and the period you spend talking about the second half of the book.
Okay, so that's a very important question. So yes, I mean, first of all, just to set a scene of why this transition. So as you say, I talk about a transition from really the 1670s, 80s onwards into the early 18th century. Why that period? Because it's in that period that you have a fundamental transition in terms of trade and in terms of currency. So until that time, the greatest value being exported from Africa was still largely actually the gold in terms of capital value, which came from the Gold Coast largely, but also from Senegambia. And it was after that time that you have this transition and the transatlantic slave trade expands immensely and you have this huge transformation and this commercialization of people, as we were just talking about. What you also have, and this is why the global geopolitical aspect is so relevant to understanding the impact in Africa, is in the 1690s you have this huge gold strike in Brazil, in what's now in Minas Gerais, the general mines, in Belo Horizonte, what's now the Belo Horizonte region of Brazil. And that means that the capital dynamics of the Atlantic are completely transformed through that gold strike. And that also has an influence in West Africa, of course. Now, Congo lived through the kind of things which then emerged in the 18th century in a way earlier. And the reason for that is that it was the region of what's now Angola, and the Kingdom of Congo was located in the north of what's now Angola. It was that region which really witnessed the impact of the transatlantic slave trade, which became so immense from the late 17th and into the 18th century everywhere else, but earlier. So they witnessed that from the late 16th century through to the late 17th century. Congo, which had been a powerful kingdom before the arrival of the Portuguese in the late 15th century, its many Congos, its rulers had converted to Christianity. There'd been a substantial trading presence, a substantial trade not only in captives in the 16th century, but also in cloths, which were woven in Congo and were highly prized. But once the Portuguese founded Luanda in 1575, warfare became endemic to the south of Congo. Actually, also, that there is a climate element here. Desertification grew into the 17th century, warfare increased, and the transatlantic slave trade boomed hugely, what some historians call an Angolan wave of captives coming from Angola, what's now Angola, into the Americas. And the inequalities which encapsulated that, and the instability, political, but also geographical, climatic, which were happening at that time, created more and more resentment against the rulers of Congo. And in the 1665, the Kingdom of Congo was defeated by the Portuguese in a major battle at Mwila, and the Congo descended into civil war for the next 40 years, essentially, and what had been a powerful kingdom fragmented, and ultimately, although it remained in a residue, a core in the 18th century, all its old power had gone, and that really encapsulates in many ways what happened in the 18th century in many other parts of West Africa. So you have this sense of the growing inequalities, growing divisions between rulers and subjects, and then at the end of the 18th century, you have a huge wave of civil wars, insurrections against the aristocracy and their overthrow.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate just a little bit upon that, on what forces are driving this. You've already described how we're talking about these economically disruptive forces, but you've also introduced some other aspects which play a role. Well, for example, we're talking about how you're seeing religions playing a somewhat different role. You're talking about the growing centralization of power and how that's disruptive. How are all these things contributing to this issue of inequality? And are we just talking about internal inequality, or are we talking about Africa, this region of Africa, relative to the rest of the world?
We're talking about both, actually. So let's take the first three. Let's take the first of those cases, you know, what's happening within West African societies. So as I mentioned before, actually, there's this relationship in terms of state building between taxation, growing state and militarization, and that's called the fiscal military state for historians of Europe. But we can actually see very similar processes happening in Africa, analogous processes happening in Africa. One of the reasons that historians have not focused on this before is because there has been within the economic historiography an idea that these currencies, cowries, manilas, and so on, are not real currencies. They were known as primitive currencies. And so the idea that this was an important process of fiscalization and taxation was never taken seriously. But actually, we see very clearly from the sources that by the time you get to the 18th century, states like Oyo in what's now southern Nigeria, Dahomey in Benin, these were states which had important taxation systems on the cowrie trade, used those cowries to fiscalize, to procure weapons, for example, and to centralize power. And so what you have is the centralization of power, just as you have in European states in the same period, the centralization of power, the monopoly of violence through the state, the growth of armies. And of course, when armies grow, you know, there's no point in having an army if it's not going to fight wars. And so the increase in warfare, of course, exactly the same processes happen in Europe in the same period, which is an incredibly bloody period, full of rife with warfare, known to be. And so it's very ironic that when by the late 18th century, people in Britain, abolitionists, and those who wanted to maintain the slave trade were writing about Africa at this time. They used this warfare as an example of how the slave trade had driven Africa into the ground. Of course, this warfare was a byproduct of the state formation process in Africa, as it had been in Europe. But the difference, and the fundamental difference, is, I think, that within was that centralization of power, it was, as you mentioned, Mark, related to the centralization of religion. So whereas religious shrines in many parts of West Africa had often been localized, related to households or specific pieces of land, in Dahomey, which is a very good example of this, that localized religious practice after Dahomey emerged as a really powerful state in the 1720s and 1730s was centralized among certain cults like the leopard cult Agassou in the capital. And it became also, because it was associated with that centralization, it was also associated with the state and with the monopoly of violence which the state held, which was related to the transatlantic slave trade. So all those forces were becoming combined, you know, growing on the one hand, centralization of power within a state such as Dahomey, which saw complete control of violence and monopoly of violence, which states always held. But on the other hand, the relationship which that had to the export of captives, often there might be subjects. And that created a growing division between that ruling class and the subjects within a state such as Dahomey, and a sense also that the religious power and autonomy which people had also gone to the capital at Abomey and made people more open to other forms of religious practice. And that's how also religious transformations began to provide a vehicle for insurrections when they came in the late 18th and into the early 19th centuries.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, Mark, this book took a long time. And what I'm working on now is recharging my batteries so that I can take up a new project within the next year or two.
Well, I look forward to finding out what that new project is when you settle upon it, because if it's half as good as this one here, it's going to be another very fascinating read.
Thank you very much, Mark. I've enjoyed it very much.
Toby, thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.